Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
In April 2014 in Leeds, England, a 61-year-old teacher was brutally stabbed to death in front of a class of students. Her 15-year-old killer had fantasised about the murder for years and openly shared his warped desires with friends. On the day of the killing, he even had shown classmates the 8-inch knife he planned to use, and incredibly, no one reported his intentions to teaching staff. This is what happens when a psychopathic mindset and bystander apathy combines with deadly consequences. This is the murder of Anne Maguire. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi guys, welcome back to my channel. Thanks for joining me. Today's case is a really local one to me. It's just 30 miles down the road. So it's one that I've wanted to cover. But as ever, I just wanted to make sure that when I was covering it, there was some additional information that maybe you haven't heard about before. If you aren't in the UK, this is a case you might not have heard about, but it was massive because you cannot begin to appreciate the absolute juxtaposition of being a teacher, somebody who is there to inspire, somebody is there who is to create the next generation of thought leaders, being in that position and trying to do your best without realizing that an individual is harboring these dark and malevolent thoughts towards you to such a degree that literally they are willing to end your life. The story of Anne Maguire is one of these that really resonates because I was somebody who worked with young people who were actually known to be quite violent at times and disruptive and dysfunctional for a long period of time, and never in any of my years did I consider that any of them were a threat. That's how rare it is. Even when you're in a situation with young people who have an expectation of certain behavioural issues, it was never something that even crossed my mind. And for Anne Maguire, who was just a great teacher, that couldn't have been anything that she ever considered potentially happening. Let's get on with today's story, because it is one of those that, like I said, any of you working with children will find it relatively blindsiding. So Anne Maguire, who was she? Well, first of all, she was a really pro-social, lovely lady. She was a very much loved wife. She was a loved mother, sister, aunt. She was born and raised in Wigan, Lancashire, literally just down the road from me. And it feels as if she had always had that vocation within her. She knew she wanted to be a teacher from the very beginning. And her family described her as being a shining light who was just literally a joy to be with. People were drawn to her bright personality. She had this incredible zest for life. There are some people, aren't there, who just have a life that's fully lived. And that's the description of Anne Maguire. She radiated happiness and positivity. And I think we can all look back to teachers in our lives that seem to have those sunny dispositions, who can make a bad day that's quite blue feel a lot lighter. And this is the kind of individual she was. She was selfless. She apparently had this real trait where she could make you feel like you were the most important person in the world when you were in her company. And I think that's really rare. Today, I think we live in a really distracted world where you see people on their phones all the time, even in groups. And it's a kind of addiction that's causing people to feel more isolated and abandoned. And when you have a teacher who arguably changes that state and can speak to you as if you have real meaning, for some children, that can be the only adult that pays them any interest. And I think that that's a real testament to who she was. Even as a young girl, apparently she was somebody who would visit the sick. She helped the elderly in a local community. So she is somebody from the real get-go who just knows how to be a really pro-social part of the world that she lives in. She had been married to her husband, Dom, for 37 years. So they had a really successful partnership. And in today's age, we all realize the divorce rate is really high, 50%. For 37 years, these two have navigated, negotiated, compromised, and find ways forward within their relationship to sustain that path. They had met in 1972 and they had two children, Emma and Kerry. So just going to throw it out there. Obviously, great taste when it comes down to child names. Also, they had raised their two nephews, Daniel and Andrew, because Anne's sister had died. And again, what is that telling us about her? What is that telling us about their partnership as well? Because that's a huge amount of stress to go through. To lose your sister is just desperately sad. But then to think, well, how can we step up and step in? How can we create a scenario where her children are brought up in a way that she would have wanted, and to be the voices and the physical beings that opportunity-wise offers that to those children, it says something again about them. So we get to April 2014. At this point, Anne was 61 years old, and she was really looking forward to her retirement, and that would have been in 5 months' time. So we're talking about a 41-year teaching career. She had spent 41 years teaching Spanish at Corpus Christi Catholic College in Leeds, Yorkshire. Now that is dedication, and that is testament again to somebody who had just found the right place and space. And whenever somebody has had a very long-term position, I think it embodies a lot of different things that says positive regards about who they are as human beings. Because to sustain relational experience with people around you, to be regarded and respected in such a way, to be a part of their foundation, that means that you have the ability to be consistent, passionate, you've got longevity, and that means that you're somebody who believes that what you're doing is a really good thing, and you're an individual who is determined and connected to that environment. And again, that's resonant of who we're describing where Anne is concerned. She was actually described as the mother of the school. And I think that any of you mums out there know that that is probably the biggest compliment that we could ever experience given to us at work. It embodies so many positive things, nurturer, guider, mentor, all of these things that Anne was clearly noted as. She was someone who could be a tough teacher, that was noted, that she really believed in getting the best from her pupils, so she would push them, but she was consistently acting in their best interest. Nobody felt that it came from malevolence or malice or an unfair requirement. It was because she saw the best in those kids and she wanted those kids to see and do and be their best. She wanted to get the best out of them. She wanted them to achieve what they were capable of. And so she didn't take prisoners, but she didn't take prisoners because essentially she wanted them to be liberated, to experience the world around them that she believed they were deserving of. And she apparently had this incredible gift where she would just see the true potential in all her pupils, and she wanted them all to succeed. And her students recognized this quality. They knew that she genuinely cared for them. She knew that she was somebody who was going to go the extra mile for them. In fact, she was known to always stay behind because if a kid was struggling, she wanted them to get the additional help. So if you needed that extra support, she was there. And a lot of the students, after the horrible incident we're going to cover today, were asked to kind of describe who she was to them. And they said, well, actually, you know what? I would have considered her more of a friend than a teacher because she genuinely wanted me to be the best person I could be. And she made me feel comfortable and at ease. And she went the extra mile. So she's this really much loved and well-respected teacher at the school, both by teachers and pupils alike. And she loved her job. For her, it was genuinely her life's vocation. Now, we appreciate when you're a teacher, just like when I was running Pupil Referral Unit, which is essentially a place where you send students who have, shall we say, failed in mainstream and are sent to work with you, obviously there are periods and points where a young person doesn't necessarily like you, and that's okay. Personality clashes happen, and the reality of relationships is complex, and you know you're not always going to get it right, even if you really want to connect with a student. They have to be engaged in that way. And there are always going to be individuals who you engage with less or who don't take to you as much as you would wish. And it's a work in progress. I always used to say that when I was with students who particularly, shall we say, took a dislike to me for a period of time. For me, that was always an invite to figure things forward, to work things out, to help them see me in a different light, and to not personalize it, to take it personally at all, to just recognize that there was something about me in that moment. Maybe I represented somebody, maybe I was being too positive in a world of dysfunction where they hadn't had that positivity. Maybe I was somebody who was too much because I've got quite a gregarious personality. Maybe I was somebody who they felt they hadn't experienced in their world because I was trying to be this really positive, supportive voice. And for them, they hadn't necessarily encountered that and it felt fake to them. So there are all these moments and issues and realities that play into these situations. You don't always get students liking you. But for Anne, on the whole, she really was liked by everybody, aside from 15-year-old William Corning. Now, she taught him Spanish since 2009, and she knew he didn't like her. He made absolutely no bones about that. He was quite happy to let Anne know that she really wasn't his cup of tea. For example, at a parents' evening in November 2013, he'd actually refused to see her. And subsequently, in the February 2014, she'd had another run-in with him. Apparently, she had banned him from going on a bowling trip. He'd failed to complete a homework assignment. And this is really common. People agree with that kind of behaviour and disagree with that kind of behaviour. But as a teacher, you need to have some consequential realities to people's behaviours. And he had not gone ahead and done what she had asked. And the consequence was he was going to be alienated from that trip. But he didn't care. So Corning had just disobeyed her and gone on the trip. Anyway, with respect, that's a failing on the school's part. At the end of the day, how can a teacher have any power and consequences unless they are implemented? Anyway, she's obviously unhappy with the fact that he isn't engaging in the way that he should. Also, he misses a detention that she's given him. So then a meeting with his parents and Anne took place. During this meeting, he was really rude and disrespectful to her. And again, that is not consistent with what we expect. Listen, everybody knows, because we've all been kids. We've all been kids. We've all been disrespectful. We've all been a little bit rude at times. But usually, they're with and in situations that we have a level of control over. Doing that in front of a teacher who is much more powerful than you, and doing it in front of your parents shows an absolute lack of regard. One could say a callousness for the situation. And I think that this is resonant of the individual that we're talking about where Cormac is concerned. Because in that scenario, it would be far better for you to just nod politely and agree that you've been a bit of a dick. But if you're not concerned about the way that other people feel about you, then you're not going to wear that mask of acceptability. Now, because of this behaviour, he gets placed on an internal exclusion. Now, that means that you remain on your school campus, but essentially you are separated from the other students. You're removed from your normal classes. And arguably, it's a way of saying, listen, you adapt and change your behaviour, or this is going to become more problematic. You know, we all know that we want to be around our peers, and if we're not being given that opportunity, that should ideally impact on us and make us feel like we want to adapt and change. But like I said, Cormac isn't the typical kind of school student that we're talking about right now. And I feel that when she is placing these kind of obstacles that are really required in front of him, she has absolutely no idea of the internal explosions that are occurring within Cormac. Now, she knows that he is not her biggest fan, but she cannot have computed at any point the extent of these almost incalculably enormous negative feelings that he's harboring towards her. So who is Cormac? Because at first glance, one can say, well, just a young man who's experiencing some dysfunction, who doesn't really like to be controlled, like a lot of young people don't like to be controlled, but there is nothing too alarming about his behaviour in these scenarios. We've seen them play out before. Hey, we see kids get suspended and excluded from school permanently. But there is just something brewing within this boy. Cormac was born on the 26th of June, 1998. Now, his parents separate when he was around 4 or 5, but very much with respect to them, he had a really good, supportive upbringing. His father was somebody who was still very present in his life. That's Ian Cormac. He was a council executive. And as a child, this boy had been very much loved, cared for. There was nothing dysfunctional about his childhood, aside from the separation. We could argue that's a level of...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dysfunction, but it's also quite typical today. So nothing that's going to be really outstanding for him. Came from a really respectable, good family. Lived with his mother, Michelle Ledbetter. She was a human resources director, so both clearly professionals as parents. He had an older brother, and his older brother lived in a semi-detached house just a mile from school. So again, we're seeing lots of pro-social realities there. Clearly his brother's done well. And neighbours said, you know what, they were just a really normal, quiet family. They weren't trouble causers. There was nothing that stood out. And I do appreciate that it can sound a bit judgy when we talk about other people in situations with parents and families where they are problematic, and therefore there is an expectation of certain dysfunctional behaviour. But that's because statistically that is absolutely evident. It is more unusual to find really good, supportive families who've been pro-socially adaptive and seem to be doing very well and living professional careers and have great lives, to have kids that just don't follow through. We're always looking at the pen portrait of possibility and the fractures in the foundations of these individuals. And when you're looking at the reflection historically of Cornick, there is nothing that seems to be standing out to draw our attention to a potential malevolent behavior. Also, as a student, he was considered really bright, really conscientious. He had a 100% attendance record. 100% in my entire history at school, I never got a 100%. These days, I would never have been allowed on any of the school trips, because they do that, don't they? If you get over a certain amount of absence, you're not allowed to go on any of the treats. I wouldn't have even tried. I think when I was at high school, maybe 20% was my attendance record. So this says something about the fact that educationally he felt that he was doing well. He clearly didn't see school as a horrible place, because he's going there every single day. And when we consider the fact that he's quite happy to let his teacher know that he doesn't like her, and he's quite happy to flaunt the rules that have been placed upon him. If he didn't want to go to school, you would imagine, because of the way I've described his character, he just would elect not to go. So there must have been quite a positive environment for him. Now, he was considered by his peers quite reserved. He was one of those people who wasn't out there being really extrovert in his nature. But they also said he was really amicable. He was described as a delightful and pleasant pupil. I mean, that is something that every parent wants to see when they get their reports, isn't it? A delightful and pleasant pupil. So there are no warning signs currently. Now, in 2014, it's year 11 for him, which is the year that he'll take his GCSEs. And he'd already taken and passed 5 the previous year. So this is an academic student. Cornick actually had a dream as well. You know, he knew where he was going. And his dream was that he wanted to join the army. And he did have something really blindsiding happen, which must have been soul-destroying for him, bearing in mind that he wants to go in the army. He knows that he can go in the army. His results are excellent. So he'd also probably looking at quite a positive path in the army. But that whole dream just gets absolutely ruined, because he's on a family holiday in Cornwall and he collapses. And at that point, he gets diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he's 12 years of age. And that means it ends any possible army career. And that would be something that would be absolutely distressing. When you want a particular path and it's robbed from you in a way that you have no control over, there is nothing you can do about it, it is the end of, then it's going to be traumatic. And so I think we can note that at 12, he's had that experience of trauma, and he's had hopes and dreams and aspirations stolen. And that would potentially create an internal rage. Also, interesting that he wants to go in the army, because We have different types of human being who want to go in the army, and obviously for the most part they are individuals who genuinely want to be able to protect society. They want to fight for their country. They're willing to die for their country, which is something I genuinely can't relate to, but I think it's absolutely impressive beyond belief that these individuals exist and are willing to sacrifice in the way that they are willing to sacrifice. But we could also say that a really tiny portion of those individuals could be psychopaths. Because if you're willing to put yourself in those positions and you're not necessarily somebody who's going to even suffer from trauma because you're quite happy to go out and do things that the rest of us would have a conscience over, then you might believe the army is a good fit for you as well. Like I said, they would be a tiny minority, and arguably they'd be a tiny minority that are still trying to find a place to use their natural personality characteristics and beliefs to do something less damaging than, shall we say, going out and commit crime. The point is, there are individuals who will be like that. So it could be that he's fitting more that paradigm. Now, people said, who knew him, when that diagnosis happened, it was catastrophic for him. So his personality changed and he started to self-harm. So again, when individuals start to self-harm, it means that they are carrying an inordinate amount of emotional trauma and pain, and it's so overwhelming at times that they decide that the best way to manage that is to physicalize it. It's not because they want to harm themselves, it's just that the harm physically feels less distressing than the emotional baggage that's being carried around. And that must have been awful for him. It must have been awful for his family as well, to see this child full of hope and aspiration suddenly go down a path of self-destruction. And they also said he became a lot more introverted. He was a lot more of a loner. And suddenly he starts to have this obsession with violent video games. Again, video games that are violent are incredibly popular with young people. And the idea that we're going to suggest for 1 minute that if you're playing violent video games, you are going to be a likely threat to other people is just not played out in any of the research whatsoever. And it would be unfair to do that. However, there will be individuals who, shall we say, have character flaws and fractures, who, should we say, should not expose themselves to lots of negative material, violent material, distressing material. Because again, if we're looking at desensitization, and even with an average child, a level of desensitization will temporarily occur after being exposed to violent material. But if you already have, like I said, those fractures, that could be more problematic and exacerbate some more malevolent behavior. So with him, it would be better if he was avoiding that kind of material. And it feels as if this is also a point, and bear in mind, we're talking about a pivotal time in childhood, you know, 13 years of age, for example. That is something that every single one of us have been through. It should be banned. There should be a very clear and simple ban on being 13. We should probably get to 11, and then they should wake us up around 24. At that point, it'll all be okay. But at the end of the day, apparently that's not legal and probably isn't healthy. But what I'm trying to say is, on a pivotal level, when you get to 13, it can be really difficult. But for him, aside from connecting with, shall we say, darker material, he also starts to express some really worrying and violent desires. So he talks about really wanting to hurt people, to kill people. And a lot of children fantasize. I think we've all been there. For example, if you get dumped in your teenage years, it's not like you don't occasionally have lots of worrying thoughts that go through your mind when you imagine that person meeting another individual and what you would like to do to that individual should they meet them. It's not that you're ever thinking about actioning those feelings. It's a way of soothing and experiencing the catharsis of playing out that idea in your head, because you're just so full of angst, and teenage angst is incredibly painful. But at times, if a young person is constantly talking about wanting to hurt people and kill people, it is a big red flag, because it isn't the normal typology expected for these kind of age frames. We expect kids to be occasionally dealing with difficult feelings and the rest of the time just naively getting on with their lives, worrying about relationships, thinking about exams, you know, going out with mum and dad. All of those things are kind of normal, but it feels like he was exacerbating and amplifying these kind of behaviours, and his classmates actually referred to him at this point as a weirdo. Now, around this time, this is when he was in year 8, so that's 12, 13, he develops a grudge And this grudge is all around his Spanish teacher, Anne. Now, the reason for this is she would not let him drop Spanish. Now, we've all been in a situation in school where a teacher has control and power over us, and it can be very challenging. If you are unhappy doing a subject and you do not want to do it, and you basically ask not to have to do that, and it's refused, meaning that you have to manage the difficult feelings, then understandably, you will resent that person. And sometimes I do think it's really important for teachers to listen to a child, because even if you think that they are outstandingly bright and they are capable, if you aren't listening to their fears and their feelings, it can understandably make them feel that they have a lack of power in their world. And kids already have a serious lack of power anyway. And understandably, when you have a lack of power, you seek to figure out ways and strategies to regain some of that. And unfortunately for Anne, I think that's a sliding doors moment. By the way, this is not in any way excusing what he does. I'm just saying, from a child's perspective, when you hoard resentment, it's often because you haven't had an outlet to manage those feelings in a more accommodated and positive way. And I think this is what's happening. So she refuses to let him drop Spanish, and the resentment just develops into this irrational, completely unnecessary hatred of his teacher. It's completely misplaced, but it feels like that is the seed that starts to grow. Now, shortly after, he has this run-in with her. And this is because he's been placed on that internal isolation away from his friends. And it's getting to a point now where he's feeling really angry with her. And he messages a friend. This is the 24th of February, 2014. And to his friend, he expresses just the extent of the feelings that he has towards Anne. And he describes it this way: the one absolute fucking bitch that deserves more than death, more than pain, torture, more than anything that we can understand. So totally misplaced when you think about what she's actually done. I mean, she's just being an absolutely normal teacher, but he's fixating and projecting and amplifying all of these really dark feelings and behaviours, and really feels that she is responsible for this and that she deserves retribution. That's the only word that really fits this situation: retribution. Now, what I will note as well is that Anne isn't the only person that he expresses dislike of, because he does dislike teachers in general, but without a doubt, it's Anne that he has this particular hatred of. And he also would speak to friends quite regularly about the fact that he desired to kill her. And again, a lot of teenagers, in fact, forget it, a lot of people in general will have moments where you'll genuinely sit there and have the most darkest of thoughts about people who hurt you, and you would discuss it with friends. But the difference is, on the whole, it's fleeting, and it's not something that becomes, shall we say, a big part of who you are personality-wise. But that isn't the case with this kid. He's genuinely constantly talking about wanting to kill her to several friends, begins carrying a knife. And at school, he would even get the knives out. He'd draw the blade up his arm. He'd even break the skin and he'd make it bleed. Now, that is deeply distressing. That says something is going on without a doubt within him psychologically. He's obviously dealing with some distressing thoughts and feelings on one level. But also, what we have to remember is, if he is a psychopath, and just put it into the context that this is the kind of character we're dealing with without a doubt, what we know about psychopaths is they don't get the same feedback, fear, anxiety, stress, and pain-wise. So a psychopath will typically have a higher pain threshold. So even though it's looking really awful when he's breaking his skin and making it bleed, the chances are the feedback may not be the same for him as it would be for somebody who's really emotionally distressed. And I think as well, he wants to stand out for all the wrong reasons to his friends. It's giving him some kind of visibility in a world where maybe he didn't really feel visible at all. And he goes around at one point even asking friends to kill Anne for him and suggests that he'll pay them £10 if they would do it. Just gonna throw it out there. Just on a common sense level, any young person is not going to see £10 as an accurate thing for a hit on anybody's life. And I guess that's why they were underestimating the reality of what he was saying, because these are kids who would have thought to themselves, like, life is way worth more than £10. And the consequence of hurting somebody for that kind of money doesn't make any sense. So it wouldn't have necessarily felt real. Also, he's seeing this girl at some point and he actually offers to get her involved in the murder plot. Apparently he says that they'll kill her and then they can go on the run. And she reacted by ending their relationship shortly after. So props to her. I mean, literally, this is the kind of young girl that we would all admire. Sorry, what are you saying? I've decided that I'm going to kill my teacher. And I think it would be a good thing for you and I to share when people think about common interests. Apparently long-lasting relationships share common values and interests, and I want you to value my interest, which is in killing my teacher, and I want us to do it together, so it's a shared activity that we can both enjoy, and that will apparently help with compatibility and longevity in our relationship. How do you feel about that? I'm just going to back slowly out of the door now, going to close the door now, and now running for the hills. Very sensible young person. We have to acknowledge when somebody realizes that there is something just not quite right in that individual and makes an elected decision to remove themselves from the scenario, that says something positive about their mindset. Although it's a shame she didn't then go and talk to somebody about it, but these are kids. We have to remember that. I think it's really tough when we cover cases like we're going to today, where there are lots of failings and opportunities and things that could have changed because of those missed opportunities. We're dealing with kids and they have not got the conscience, understanding or experience of the world, which enables them to fully understand the intention of certain individuals. Now, she ends that relationship and he obviously would have been affected by that. But I doubt his egocentricity and arrogance would have allowed him to think that that was the thing that ended it. Now, he later would state that the idea of killing Anne had literally been consistently on his mind since year 8. So for 3 years, he's been fantasizing about this. Now, whilst he hadn't expressed these desires to his parents, what I would say is certainly by Christmas 2013, his mother knew that he had a really serious issue with Anne. So he's obviously telling her about this, and we'd expect that because they have a close relationship and he confides in his mother, and arguably she's a safe place and a safe space, and we would want that for him. But what she doesn't realise is that even though he's telling her that he has this issue with Anne, he's actually messaging his friend on Facebook, this is Christmas Eve, stating his intention to brutally kill his teacher and to spend the rest of his life in jail. So even though mum knows that he's got these feelings that are negative towards Anne, she has absolutely no idea, ballpark-wise, where we are going with this. But he's talking to his friend about this, says he'd claimed to have heard voices in his head that would tell him to do it. So he's basically cooking up a medical defense and wants to get treated more leniently. So he's really considering and premeditating the reality of the potential actions. And he had this, what I would say was a real irrational conclusion psychologically. And that was that he could never be happy whilst Anne was still alive. And if he didn't kill her, he'd have to kill himself. Now that is so unnecessary, isn't it? It's such a all or nothing mentality. And don't get me wrong, black and white thinking is something that we see often when people are struggling emotionally. So it's either an everything or a nothing perspective. If I don't do A, then it's going to be B. And of course, it misses out all the most important nuanced grey areas. And it's irrational and it's uncomplicated as well to some degree, because it's only two choices. I do this or I do this. But problematic, because like I said, there's no nuanced thinking behind it. And the idea that if I don't kill her, I have to kill myself is so extreme, but also so demonstrative of that black and white thinking. It's one of the things that we really have to unpick with clients, because people will come in and say, if I don't do this, this is going to happen. And often they're missing the really important keys and other opportunities and choices that could be made in between. It's drastic and it's very problematic. And he also messages a friend and says, as long as she's alive, I'll be depressed, sad, and angry. So there's only one thing to do. Now, again, this is really telling because he's basically put all of his eggs.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
He's in one basket. He's saying she is the root of all my sadness. She is the problem. She is the individual who's causing all my distress. And I think when we look back to when he gets a diagnosis of diabetes type 1, which obviously a very serious diagnosis, is insulin dependency, it stops him going in the army. He also coincides a lot of that feeling with her making him carry on with Spanish and making him go into isolation at school. And so there is a thread of discontent that he wrongly now connects to her. Well, all of my problems are because of this woman. Even though arguably we can see his health was one of the main issues regarding his unhappiness and the stealer of dreams, so to speak. And yet Anne seems to become this caricature and projection for him where he can put all his problems. So now, because he's decided to fixate on her, well, the easiest way to manage all of this discontent is to remove her from the picture permanently. I can't live this way, so let's get rid of her. And then whatever I'm left with will be better than what I'm feeling right now. So incorrect, but so powerful. Now, Cornet had allegedly thought about taking his own life. So there is truth to his feelings about the permanence versus impermanence state. So the permanence being, if she's around, I will always be unhappy. If she's around, there's no point me living my life. Whereas the impermanent state would suggest, well, things change. We move on. We leave school. But if you have quite pessimistic thinking, often that pervasive and permanent belief system exists. So we get to the 24th of April, 2014. And he decides, I'm not going to kill myself. I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill my teacher. Because in that warped version of reality that he is manifested and created, it's a case of kill or be killed. So there's no option. She dies or I die. So then he starts to actually play out and consider how he's going to carry out the killing. First of all, he thinks about using a blunt object. Then he thinks about a gun, even thinks about pushing Anne out of a window, but ultimately decides that he's going to use a knife. And if you think about all of those other methods, I think they're going to be more difficult. Certainly getting a gun in the UK is almost impossible. Even if you get a gun, getting bullets is really challenging, and he's a kid, so that's not going to play out. Pushing her out of a window, when you get the opportunity to do that, I can't imagine that Anne would be happily walking over to some majorly large window when he's suggesting that she looks out of it, because she's aware that he's not the nicest of kids to her. And again, blunt force trauma, it's not always that effective with respect. It's incredible how strong human beings are and how strong our skull is to some degree. So even if you go for somebody's head, you might injure them, but killing them might not play out as you'd intended. But a knife, while really easily accessible, carries around in your bag, quite easily disguised, and is completely lethal. Also, I always think a knife is such an intimate crime. You know, you're looking at the person as you are stealing their life. And if you want to have the ultimate power, then I think that is that omnipotence complex, that sense of playing God. And I think he would very much have liked that power dynamic. Now we get to Monday, the 28th of April, 2014. This is just 2 months short of Cornick's 16th birthday. Bear in mind, he's leaving school soon. He's getting out. It's over, his education. He's never going to have to see this woman ever again. But he's built up this feeling of intense resentment to the degree where leaving is not going to satiate those feelings as far as he's concerned, because he ultimately needs to let this woman know that she is deserving of all of the feelings that he's been hoarding for so many years. And essentially, even though he could just walk away, that's not going to satisfy him. Now, that day, it starts off like any other school day. Didn't seem to be anything odd about Cornick. In fact, over the weekend, he'd even been to his grandmother's birthday, seemed happy enough, was really polite. And that, I think, is really terrifying. Think about your organized serial killer. I know we're not talking about a serial killer today. I know that we're not talking about an individual who fits the actual pattern, but I'm talking about the seeds of a serial killer. An individual who can just wear a mask, fit into society, even seem pro-social, who's really intelligent, who can fly academically, and yet within them, they carry this darkness, these morbid fantasies, and more than morbid fantasies that they intend fully to activate into reality. That's what we're talking about here, aren't we, with his characteristics. He's organized, he's planned, he's premeditated. Don't get me wrong, he's clearly not thinking about anything other than the events. So he hasn't got the sophistication and consequential reality of action-based plans, which would lead to him escaping justice. But maybe he doesn't even want to escape justice because that teenage side of him is still saying, I want to be visible. I want to have a reputation. I want to be feared. I want people to know how I felt. He goes to school as usual that morning. But the things that his parents weren't aware of was that he was carrying two knives in the bag. Now, one was a small knife. The other was a large, heavy kitchen knife. It had an 8-inch blade. It was almost 2 inches wide. Also in his bag, he had a bottle of Jack Daniels because apparently he was planning to celebrate with that bottle of Jack Daniels after the killing. Meanwhile, we have Anne. She leaves the home that she's shared with her husband that morning. They'd been discussing retirement plans because it's genuinely around the corner. He couldn't have imagined when he said goodbye to Anne, his wife of so many years, a family raised together, a life lived together. And as he kisses her goodbye that morning, he can't even comprehend it's the last time he'll see his wife alive. That morning at school, Cornick goes around and tells several of the pupils that he's going to kill Anne that day. Like, he even showed the students knives. Now, most of them were like ordinary kids. They were just like, he's not being serious. This is just all talk. Will's just being Will. But others did take him seriously. And they obviously knew that there was a potential that Anne was going to come to serious harm, but they were terrified because he said, if you tell anybody I've got these knives, I'll kill you. And if you believe that somebody has this kind of potential, there's going to be two themes running through your mind. The first is, okay, he's threatening me and I'm scared, but I'm not going to take this too seriously because I've never really seen anything in his nature to indicate that he's really going to go ahead with this. And hopefully if I just ignore it and keep my mouth shut and don't snitch on the fact that he's got knives, he will just leave me alone. And of course, the other side of it is, oh, he's not going to hurt her, but he might genuinely hurt me. So it's very easy to silence younger people. It takes a really stern and strong character to break that mold. And we see bystander apathy all the time because people genuinely think it's either not going to happen or somebody else will deal with it. And psychologically, they're really powerful realities. Now, he says he's not just here to kill Anne. He's going to plan a triple homicide. So he kills, as far as he's concerned in his head, fantasy-wise, another two teachers. He wants to kill his head of year and a science teacher who is pregnant. And he even goes so far as to say, look, I'm going to stab her in the stomach because I want to kill her unborn child too. So for me, that would actually be four homicides, not three. It's as simple as that. There is a child involved as well. But what are we seeing about the malevolence within him? The fact that he'd actually want to kill an innocent baby? I, fair enough, you know, you might have some resentful thoughts towards other people who you feel have harmed or upset you, your teachers, you could certainly say have maybe done things in the past that make you resentful, but an unborn child, a child that's done absolutely nothing wrong, But he obviously has really thought this out, and he's thinking about the ultimate reputation, isn't he? Because people would look at that and think, wow, who is this kid? What's going on in their mind? And I bet he liked the idea of that. Now, he'd waited until Monday to carry out that particular attack that is planned, because he knows all three teachers are going to be there. And he actually told students he was going to go around the classrooms just picking off and stabbing teachers one by one. Now, there was only one student who saw the knife and actually later down the line reported it to another teacher, along with Cornick's threat of killing Anne. Tragically, though, by the time it was actually reported, it was too late. But I think it's really important to acknowledge the bravery of that student and also the wherewithal to actually be told something or hear about something and then sit and think about it for a while and consider the fact that it could just all be fabrication, it could just be somebody being stupid, somebody being alarmist, and trying to get some kind of reaction out of people. But is it worth taking that risk? And clearly for this student, after they've mulled it over in their head, they were like, I'm just going to go ahead and report it. And like I said, it's really sad that that report came too late. But it's also really important to note the difference between that student's mentality and the other students who failed to do that. And again, I'm being completely acknowledging of the fact these are young people. They have no idea how to manage this scenario. But you know my guys, I'm always the same. Risk offending. Be the person who speaks out, even when it's awkward, even when it might play out and be nothing. Just do that. Use your voice, because in these kind of circumstances, it can be life-saving and it can be definitely life-changing, as we are going to discuss in Anne's case. Now, after morning break, Cornick was in Anne's class, which is classroom T51, and there were some students, including Cornick, who'd actually gone into the adjoining classroom to work. Now, it's here, during doing this work in the adjoining classroom, that Cornick opens his bag and he actually shows a friend the intended murder weapon, which is the large 8-inch knife. And he actually had experimented with where he could conceal it. So he's really thinking about the long game this day. Now, shortly after 11:30 a.m., he hides the weapon beneath his clothing, gets up, winks at his friend and just leaves the classroom. Now, again, I don't think for one minute that friend thinks that anything tragic is about to play out. He's probably thinking like, okay, what is he up to? What is he doing? You're probably thinking more prank, but that's not what's going to happen. Because next door, we have a completely unsuspecting Anne. She's just sitting at a desk at the front of the class, as ever, doing what we expect Anne to be doing. She's helping a student with their work. So because she's doing that, her back's turned away from Cornick as he enters the classroom and he just walks over to her. Now, bear in mind, there is no warning whatsoever and has no expectation of what's going to occur now. I'm glad that she has no expectation with respect. But without warning, he just produces this knife and he begins frenziedly stabbing Anne in the neck, in the back, with incredible force. That was apparently how it was noted, incredible force. She was 5'2", Anne. She's tiny. She was a really petite, slim build. Now, Cornick, even though he was only 15 years of age, was 6'2". I mean, the physicality there is incalculable. Can you imagine the shock, the stunned reality as Anne realizes what's playing out? She's taken completely by surprise by this far stronger attacker. She didn't stand a chance. And of course, we have witnesses. We have a classroom full of terrified students, and they are watching in horror as Cornick repeatedly stabs their teacher in front of them. Of course, it becomes chaos. They start to run, scream, because as far as they're concerned, he's coming for them next. I mean, they've seen the films, they've watched the documentaries, they've heard about school shooters and spree killers, and all of a sudden they're in the midst of this possibility. Now, they obviously flee because they are in fear of their own lives being ended. Now, Anne is obviously dealing with this grave attack. She's been stabbed multiple times. And yet, in spite of this, she somehow manages to get to her feet. She manages to stagger from the classroom, but Cornick follows. And he just continues to stab her. Now, bear in mind, other teachers are starting to hear the commotion. And there is another teacher, Susan Francis, who is an absolute hero. As far as I am concerned, she's the head of languages. She's heard these screams. She leaves the staff room opposite because she wants to know what the disturbance is. And she notes as students run past her that behind them is Anne. And Anne is just staggering from her classroom. She's holding the back of her neck. She's bleeding so heavily. And she manages to tell her colleague, "He stabbed me in the neck." And then she just falls into her arms. And Susan, she literally shields Anne from Cornick. This young man, this huge, huge height in front of her with a knife. And yet she literally shields Anne. She doesn't care about whether he's going to stab her. She knows that she's putting her life in danger. But all that matters to her is protecting her injured colleague. She manages to get the critically injured Anne into the staff room, and then she puts her foot against the door to keep Cornick out. Can you imagine the bravery that plays out in that moment? Her courage is second to none. Firstly, she's shielding this gravely injured woman who clearly he wants to kill, and that she is preventing at that moment from him harming anymore using her own body. And then when she's in the staff room, she's using her own foot to stop him getting in. And apparently Susan recalled that Cornick's face, when she looked at it through the door, was just one of a mask of no emotion. He was just staring at her. Now at this point, of course, he can't continue the attack. So Cornick just calmly walks away, returns to his classroom, and sits back down next to his friend. How unbelievably chilling is that? He's just basically executed this poor woman who has done absolutely nothing deserving of this in any universe. He's noted the catastrophic injuries that he's inflicted on her, and he just doesn't even try to escape, because this isn't about escaping. He wants people to know what he's done. He's proud of his work. When he gets back into that classroom, some of the students are still sat in there. And as we know, that makes sense, because some people will flee, some people will fight, and some people will freeze. And those students have just kind of sat there thinking, what the hell has happened? And he comes back in and they're quiet because, of course, they don't know about his potential. They've seen what's just played out. But what really strikes them is this chilling calmness and also this sense of pride. He seems really pleased with what he'd done. And he told his friend that he'd stabbed Anne and that it was a pity she wasn't dead. And then he announced to every single student who was still present, good times. He even described his adrenaline rush. Now, you can imagine for Susan, who is dealing with her gravely injured colleague, all she cares about right now is getting emergency services. She calls them, she stays with Anne, and she apparently could see that she'd been seriously injured. She was losing a hell of a lot of blood. She could physically see the colour draining from her. And she said, "I can't breathe. I'm dying." So Anne knew. And I think that's one of the most harrowing parts, isn't it? This totally innocent, lovely mother and wife, in those final moments, knows it's over. It's unlikely that anybody's going to be able to save her. Now, whilst Susan waits with her, desperate for help, she tried to comfort her colleague. She kissed her. She stroked her head. She talked about her children. She reminded her of how loved she was. And for Susan, that, aside from being a hero and trying to protect her friend, it's also that nurturing maternal value that she offered Anne in those dying moments, to remind her of her worth, to remind her of how loved she was, to remind her of all the things that made her life so beautiful, to give her those moments before she takes her last breath, where the last words that she's hearing are about the wonder of who she is and has been in this world. And to cradle somebody into death that way, to calmly and lovingly hold that person and hold that space as they enter the next dimension, I think that was a gift beyond measure, I really do. It's something that she wished she hadn't had to do, no doubt. It's something that she wished she could have changed and could have saved Anne's life. But I think that instinct was there, that she too knew, just as Anne did, that it was over. And so she was gonna lightly cradle her as she took those last breaths, and she did that in an incredible way. Now, of course, around the school, this chatter has become an absolute loud volume because everybody knows about this attack. So two teachers end up going down to find Cornick, because obviously it's about getting him apprehended, and they actually find him and take him down to the reception area, and they wait for the police to arrive. But it's interesting, isn't it? He isn't fighting back. He knows the game's up. He's done what he set out to do. That is the most chilling part. Yes, he wanted to kill other people, but for the most part, he has achieved what he wanted to achieve. And now he knows that Anne is either gravely injured or dead. Maybe for that period of time, he's calmer. He's satiated that desire. And so he's kind of more complicit and compliant in those moments. And those teachers even said that they were just shocked because he was so calm. Like, he acted like nothing had happened. Apparently he smiled at a police officer when they arrived to arrest him. Even asked for some ice for his hand because it was hurting. Then he even went on to ask the police officer what her favourite movie was. Followed by, what is your favourite adrenaline sport? I love adrenaline sport. Now, arguably, we could also say there is a level of shock there. People do talk absolute ridiculous bubbles when they are in shock. But I know, Dolly, that's correct. They do. She's just affirming that that is true and acknowledging that this is a reality in certain circumstances where shock is actually playing out. But that, I don't think, is the reality. I think he's just, again, in an excited space. He's thrilled about what he's done. He's feeling the adrenaline coursing through his veins.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And consequently, because he's feeling that, it links to asking those questions. You can imagine, can't you, the copper just sitting there thinking, what the hell is wrong with this child? Because this is really rare. You know, what we're talking about right now, even where the authorities are concerned, is something so left field, it's absolutely unexpected. We do not expect children to kill, number one, and we certainly don't expect children to kill innocent teachers who've actually done nothing wrong. It just does not play out in our realities. Now, the paramedics arrive at the scene very quickly, and they are blown away. They can't believe the amount of blood that's in the staff room. And whilst being taken down in the lift in the school, Anne actually stops breathing and she never regains consciousness again. She was initially rushed to Leeds General Infirmary because they want to try to save her life. But despite attempting to resuscitate her for 40 minutes, she's pronounced dead at 1:10 p.m. And the only consolation in that moment is that they had managed to call her husband and he was there by her side. And that is something that is just so devastating, but also, I think for Anne, it would have been reassuring. I think that even though she was unconscious, there would just be a transcendental reality of connection between her and her husband. And I'm sure that he knew and she knew that they were still present with each other, even though she wasn't conscious. Now, one paramedic who actually treated Anne personally, they said that the stab wounds inflicted on her were the worst that she'd ever seen. And when they did the post-mortem, the injuries were just horrific. So first of all, they could tell it had been inflicted with severe force, and Anne had been stabbed 7 times to the upper back and the neck, and one of the stab wounds had literally passed all the way through her neck. Another had severely severed her jugular vein, so we all know that would be the fatal injury, because you're going to die first of shock and hemorrhage. It's as simple as that. You know, the amount of blood loss and the speed of that blood loss is just absolutely impossible to remedy. Also, they noted two stab wounds that had actually gone through her upper back and they'd shattered her ribs. So bear that in mind, it was from her back and they shattered her ribs. That's the level of force. One had even penetrated her right lung. So all of that together was just evidence of this completely ferocious attack. The pain and fear that Anne must have encountered and experienced would have been horrific. There were no defense wounds as well, because that points to the fact that she was completely unaware that it was going to occur. She'd been attacked from behind without warning. It's a completely cowardly act. And what's really upsetting as well is when you think about Anne, she was actually the eldest member of the teaching staff. So we also have to add in the fact that she was probably most likely the most vulnerable. She wouldn't have been able to defend herself. Remember how tall this guy is and how big this guy is. He was completely dominating. It would have been very different. Even if he'd stabbed a male teacher, believe me, the disparity between a male and a female reacting to this kind of situation is enormous. Men will often, even when they're smaller, have a physical chance of fighting an attacker, whereas a woman in this situation is going to be defenseless. Now, 15-year-old Cornick obviously is charged with Anne's murder. Of course he is. And he pleads guilty. Of course he does, because think about all the people who saw him witness the attack. It's terrifying, of course, to imagine that there were no real signs that this could have played out. So first of all, he's got no criminal record. The first crime that he ever notably commits is a brutal murder. And there hadn't really been any obvious warning markers. There hadn't been any real big red flags. Yes, I've covered some of them, but not enough to make us think that this was really going to play out. I mean, he'd never behaved violently prior to the killing. In fact, he only had 5 incidents of misbehavior during 4.5 years at the school. And neither his parents nor his teachers saw it coming. And of course, we have the friends, because they did say that they were aware that he had this kind of mindset. They were aware that he had this malevolence to some degree. But they said that they kept it quiet. And arguably, for the most part, they'll have kept it quiet because they'll have thought he didn't really have any intention. You know, this was just fantasy. You don't want to believe that your friends have the potential to murder other individuals. It's amazing how your bias will play in, you know, if as long as they're really nice with you and they don't seem to be exhibiting anything unusual anywhere else, well, why would you think that they had the capacity to kill? But of course, like I said, that's why the words risk offending come in. Because if you hear something that is left field, if you hear about something that seems like there is something just different about the way somebody is speaking compared to other people, it's worth highlighting it for their sake as much as for the potential victim's sake. Now, of course, the police get to examine his mobile phone. And when they do, well, there are things that are red flags. So they found loads of images of knives, and we don't expect to see that. We don't expect that young person is going around gathering those kind of images, because it does suggest there is something atypical about their behavior. Arguably, some people will say, well, I collect knives. I have massive samurai swords on my walls, for example, and I don't want to kill anybody, and I get it. But I just think when you do the jigsaw puzzle here, that is a bit of a red flag. Now, of course, when he's arrested, he gets psychologically and psychiatrically assessed multiple times, because when you go to court, even if you plead guilty, they want to know if there is any underlying mental disorder that could explain your actions. And the findings of these evaluations, shall we say, were chilling. Absolutely chilling. And it's also worth noting that the people who interviewed him, the psychiatrist and psychologist, they all reached a similar conclusion. So they said that he held feelings that were very strong and involved anger, but that they were never outwardly displayed. So he just had this seething, growing resentment and rage within. Also, they said that they found absolutely no evidence of any thought disorder, any psychosis, or any other major psychiatric illness, apart from what they said was a possible adjustment disorder. So this is usually an emotional response caused by stressful events. However, they said that they didn't believe that had any impacts on his act of killing. Also, they said there was evidence of a personality disorder. And you won't be surprised. None of you are going to be sitting there going, really? Was there a personality disorder, Emma? Yes, there was, with psychopathic traits and a preoccupation with homicide. So yeah, there was a personality disorder, you know, the antisocial type. But when I've just described the horror of what played out in this murder, that's going to be something every single one of you would have expected. Now, one psychiatric expert actually noted that he had a gross lack of empathy for his victim and a degree of callousness rarely seen in clinical practice. And when you chill the bones of the individual assessing you, you know, you are a very unusual human being. Bear in mind, these kind of professionals, this is what they do day in, day out. And if they're saying, rarely seen that in clinical practice, we are talking about something very unusual existing within this young person. Now, during the evaluation, Cornick actually referred to his victim as barely human. Is it just me, or do I find that ironic on my own? You know, when you think about what he did. He's referring to Anne, a lovely teacher, a much-loved mother, wife, aunt, much-loved professional per se, and he's referring to her as barely human. You know, one of the most human people we could have ever anticipated existing in this world is somebody like her. The most human, the most compassionate, the most loving, the most pro-social, the most altruistic, and yet he doesn't even see her that way. I mean, dehumanization plays a part, doesn't it, when people feel they have a right to kill. It's far easier to see a person that you want to murder as an object, because that makes you feel that you can project onto them your anger, your rage, your feelings, and you can minimize the impact by making out that actually it doesn't really matter because they weren't really an individual of great meaning anyway. They didn't deserve life. But like I said, massively ironic from somebody who genuinely acts in anything but human way. Now, he actually stated, I knew I was going to do it. It's what I did. I said I was going to do another stuff, but I never got a chance. Other murders. It was a triple homicide. What I have done, I couldn't give a shit. I wasn't in shock. I was happy. I had a sense of pride. I still do. I know it's uncivilized, but I know it's incredibly instinctual and human. Past generations of life, killing is a route of survival. It's kill or be killed. I didn't have a choice. It was kill her or suicide. Well, arguably, that's actually a juxtaposition, isn't it? Because you did. You could have killed yourself. Sorry, just going to say it as it is. You know, even in summing up, that choice is that it was kill her or suicide. So whilst I am not saying that anybody should want to kill themselves, and everybody who feels suicidal ideation or feelings of not wanting to be here, you need help. And you deserve help. And at times, you can have moments in your life where the easiest way out in your head, not in reality, but in your head, is, well, I'll just end myself. And of course, that's the worst thing ever. Because even if you have malevolent, dark, horrible, intrusive thoughts at times, you still deserve help and support. And it's there. Yes, it's difficult to access. Jesus, is it difficult to access? But even speaking to people who are close to you, your family, your friends, having those conversations can make a difference. So ultimately, the fact that he's saying he could kill her or he could kill himself, there is a choice involved in that statement. What he's actually saying, therefore, is, well, there was no choice because I wasn't going to kill myself. There was no choice because my life is worth more than hers. And actually, that does play into the psychopathic personality, doesn't it? The idea that he just sees himself as more superior, his own life with more meaning. And this is a kid who really hasn't got any, shall we say, future connections. Unlike Anne, she's got her kids, her grandchildren to come, etc. So a whole heap of possibilities and potentials because of the relations that she's had and the professionalism that she's grown and the love that she's acquired in her community. So ironically, potentially, she is a human being with more meaning at that moment in time, and yet he still elects to choose her life over his. Now, for me, that lack of remorse, the lack of empathy, is beyond shocking. He had absolutely no regard about the impact on Anne's family, about the wider community impact, and he stated this, I couldn't give a shit. I know the victim's family will be pissed off, but I don't care. In my eyes, everything I've done is fine and dandy. Just unbelievable when you actually think about what I'm discussing. You know, when you talk about the context of the reality of what I'm explaining, that it's fine and dandy, and that he doesn't care that he's hurt all these people, he's ruined people's lives, he's generationally impacted the future of Anne's loving family. Now, unsurprisingly, it was concluded he posed an extremely high risk of serious violence, with the possibility that he could kill again. Of course, it's obvious. With that kind of mindset, he's demonstrating it absolutely accurately himself. He doesn't need any other professional to state or support that. He's done the work himself in letting us know that he's really dangerous. We get to the 29th of September 2014. At this point, a memorial service was actually held for Anne at Leeds Town Hall. And the love and respect that people had for her was unbelievably clear. It was full to overflowing, just full of people packed there to remember the impact that she'd had on their lives, to remind her family of just how much meaning she had to the world, to the local area, to let those around them see that Anne had had this beautiful impact on so many, many lives. And I'm sure for the family, whilst that wouldn't have brought them, shall we say, any peace, it would have brought them a sense of understanding that others recognised and reflected the importance of somebody that had infinite meaning to them. And I think that would be reassuring. We get to the 3rd of November 2014. This is when 16-year-old Cornick gets sentenced at Leeds Crown Court. Now, prior to sentencing, Anne's family got the chance to read the victim impact statements to the court. Her daughter Emma said this: "There are many milestones she will miss and many that we will have to get through missing her. We will no longer look forward to occasions, our lost shadows, such things. No birthday, Christmas, Mother's Day weekend, home will ever be the same. Everything is tainted now. I just want to be able to talk to her. She won't see me get married or hold her first grandchild. This part of her life was all still to come. She was so looking forward to it. She deserved to live." And then Don, her husband of 37 years, said this: "Anne was a beautiful, vivacious, caring, generous human being. I am still a dad, but I cannot help my children understand. Can't help them come to terms. Can't help lessen the pain. Mummy would have been so much better. I can no longer be a dad. I fail every day. I need Anne. Parts of our lives have been brutally taken. The center of our lives is missing. Our very being has been diminished. Facing the world is very difficult. Facing oneself is very difficult." I think that Don just probably unknowingly puts into perspective how so many partners of victims feel, because he feels impotent to some degree, that he couldn't change what happened and he can't change the impact of how that's affected his family. And so now he hasn't got the capacity and capabilities and skill that he's required to actually build his family back, because it's impossible, because she was the piece. She's the missing piece of the puzzle, Anne. And I hope they'll find a way forward. Of course I do, but I understand every single word that he says. Psychologically, the trauma, the tragedy, it has changed everything. And for those of you who've been through traumatic loss like I have, I get that. You'll get that. It changes the shape of everything you've ever known, everything that ever was. And it transforms and transcends every experience you've ever noted before. Nothing prepares you for this. Nothing could possibly prepare him and his much-loved family for what's played out. Judge Mr. Justice Coulson, he actually details so many of the aggravating factors of the case, including the fact, of course, that it had been really premeditated, first of all. I mean, he fantasised for it for 3 years, and he thought about all those different ways he could carry it out. On the day of the killing, he'd gone to school prepared with 2 knives, so it hadn't been a spur-of-the-moment act. Also, it's the fact that he carried out the brutality of that murder in front of a classroom of children, so didn't care at all about the trauma of psychologically damaging others in the process, had no empathy for his victim or for those who witnessed the murder. And then, of course, there's a complete lack of remorse. He'd actually told authorities he felt happy, proud about what he'd done, didn't care about the impact on Anne's family or the wider community or the school. In his own words, he couldn't give a shit. And you know what? Some people will say, well, maybe that was just a reputational act. Maybe he just wants to look like the hard guy. And it's like, yeah, I get that. That's human bias. We don't want to think that kids are capable of this. But no, he really doesn't give a shit. His actions demonstrate that perfectly. Cornick ended up getting sentenced to life with a minimum term of 20 years. So that means the earliest he could be released is 2034. He'll be 35 then. Now, the judge did say, when you look at the psychiatric evaluation, the reality is he may never be released. And arguably, we think, good. Because like I said, even if he could change, even if with growth and age, there is some kind of understanding and consequential reality and some conscience forming, do we take a risk? Do we allow somebody like that with such a cold, calculating executioner within him to walk our streets again? And in 2015, Cornick actually lost an appeal against his sentence, so he's obviously tried to get it reduced, which again says something about a lack of remorse. You know, serve your sentence. Serve your minimum sentence, knowing that at 35, if there is a hope that you get out, well, hey, you'll literally get to live two more lifetimes out there. You'll be potentially 95 when you die. So essentially, 35 years, you've got the rest of your life ahead of you. And yet you want more after you've stolen so much from Anne's family. Now, Anne's family were really dissatisfied, actually, because there was a council learning lessons review into her death that got carried out. And they felt that the panel who were involved, they were really ill-informed. They really disagreed with the conclusion that the killing could...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Not have been avoided. And I can completely understand how they'd feel that way, because there were red flags as far as this boy going around showing people knives, and obviously one person speaking to a teacher, and arguably any missed opportunities is going to make them feel like Anne could have been somebody who survived and wouldn't have been murdered this way. So Anne's family generally feel really let down by the authorities. They feel let down by the treatment that they received. They felt that Cornick and his family were actually treated with more care and empathy, with a focus on the killer's best interest. I mean, would that not send you under? And I appreciate Cornick's family are not responsible for who he is and his actions, and we have to remove them from that picture. But sorry, why are we caring about the killer's best interests? Like, he should be the last person on the list of care and compassion. He lost his right to care and compassion when he brutally slayed an innocent woman doing a job that she loved. He was somebody so full of hate that he was willing to kill an unborn child if he got the chance. Why do we care about his rights at all? This is where the world has gone completely insane. No wonder Anne's family feel resentful. I would feel resentful. How dare anybody ignore the victim in these situations? And so often it's the case. And a lot of the time that's down to the fact that authorities want to protect themselves, but that means no lessons are ever learned. That means no change ever occurs. And it's shame on them when they do that, because it means that it leaves the door open for other terrible situations to play out. Now, findings of a subsequent inquest, which was released in November 2017, they found that Anne had been unlawfully killed. No shit, Sherlock, really. Did they need anything put in writing that would note that? I mean, it's pretty obvious. But what they did note with respect to them was that the murder could, to some degree, have been prevented, potentially. So on the day of the killing, Cornick had actually told at least 10 students that he planned to kill Anne and two other teachers. Yeah. Now, some had thought he was joking, but some knew he was serious. They'd even been in a situation where he'd showed several students the weapon that he intended to use, yet only one had alerted another member of staff, and by that time, it was too late. This is literally a perfect example of bystander apathy. Anne's family obviously wanted those pupils who'd been involved to be compelled to testify at the inquest, because one of the things that they wanted was to get them questioned. You know, why did you fail to raise the alarm? Why did you fail to tell people what you knew? Because if they got them to actually be on the stand at the coroner's court and have to be somebody who gave evidence at the inquest, their motivation as the family of Anne was that this would prevent similar tragedies potentially happening in the future. But that request was denied. And I can understand that what the coroner's inquest would believe is that potentially putting children through more trauma when they obviously weren't responsible for what played out is something that could be psychologically very damaging. But what we have to also acknowledge is that Anne's family have to live with this, and they would have had questions. And not having those questions answered is something that causes further fractures to an already intolerable situation. So I can completely understand their frustration. And I can also have sympathy with why the authorities said no, because those kids were not responsible. And even though, yes, one can look and say, well, failures occurred because they could have said A, B or C to this person, that person, or the other, I doubt very much that on reflection, any of them would do anything but act in the best interest of Anne, but they can't. So placing them in a situation where they're going to get bamboozled by questions and further traumatised potentially is going to cause more harm to our society, because it's going to affect many people. And instead, they're just holding that space and saying, well, Anne's dead. You are dealing with the trauma. I'm sorry, it's not going to give you the answers that you want, but we're not willing to traumatise anybody else in the process. But I would feel as frustrated as anybody if I was Anne's family, because for them, this is so personal, and they feel that there were so many missed opportunities. And I have absolute empathy and sympathy with that. Now, some of the students who were actually being asked to essentially give the evidence, they've stated that they're totally haunted by their failure to act, that they feel that maybe they could have prevented the killing. And again, that is not a cross that any of them should bear. And they are victims too, even though you can look in and say, well, they should have done A, B and C. Like I said, they are victims too. They could never really have anticipated the horror that really was going to play out. Now, Cornick, you won't be surprised, has actually never given an explanation as to why he murdered Anne. Yep, he's got diagnosed with a personality disorder with psychopathic tendencies, and that's definitely accurate. Now, initially, he didn't even get named in the press because of his age, but eventually a court did rule that anonymity should be lifted because they wanted to act as a deterrent to others. Now, many in the psychological and psychiatric world were angry about this. Honestly, they felt that a child was being labelled and demonised for life. Look, we've seen it before in the Bulger cases. You know, Venables and Thompson, they essentially will get new identities and have new identities for the rest of their lives because they think it's too dangerous for these kids when they've been released from their secure units to go into general society and not incur the wrath and harm of those around them. But it's galling, because it's like, you know, if the cap fits, wear it. If you're a murderous slayer of people and you get caught for that, well, you know what? That is your cross to bear for that behaviour. But a lot of professionals feel, well, that's going to mean this person's stigmatized for the rest of their life. But hey, that's a debate, isn't it? Should they not be stigmatized? You know, if the shoe fits. Now, after his incarceration, as I expected when I started researching this case, he loves the infamy his crime attracted. He loves the fact that people know that his actions were so reprehensible. He enjoys the reputational reality. And I think that was his main motivation. He wanted to be visible. He wanted to be that person who broke the moral code and the ethical reality of the world that we build around us. And he likes the fact that he did that. He likes the power. He likes the acclaim. He likes to put fear into others about his potential. He's destroyed the lives of Anne's family, and yet he has this complete lack of remorse. And that must make it even more difficult for them, knowing that this guy just couldn't care less. He enjoys the notoriety her murders brought him. Now, on a point of legacy, something that has occurred is the Anne Maguire Arts Education Fund has been established in her memory. That's because they want to continue the really amazing work that she did during her 4 decades of teaching. Now, this fund actually provides bursaries and funding for the enhancement and personal development of the under 18s through music, drama, language and dance. And that is one thing that Cornick can't steal. He can't steal the impact that this woman had in the world. He can't steal the legacy that her incredible work leaves. He can't steal the love of her family, who will keep her memory generationally going. Yes, her end was grotesque, diabolical, and should not have occurred, but her life was just so fully loved and fully lived and absolutely abundant with meaning. And they are going to ensure that her name goes down in history for all of those positive traits, unlike the reality of Cornick, whose name will be remembered for far darker reasons. And yes, he may reputationally enjoy the fact that people fear him now, but believe me, prison gets very, very boring and very, very dangerous. And whilst right now he may still sit smugly enjoying the notoriety of his actions, after 10, 20 years, that feeling gets old. I hope you found today's case interesting. Our thoughts go out to Anne's family, who are just incredible. The legacy of that woman will last for many lifetimes. She's impacted on so many students over her years and changed and directed their lives in positive ways and outcomes. She will always be within people's memory banks, and that makes her life continue, even though she didn't get to continue it personally. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.